thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to That Great Business Show, episode 69, posting on the 7th of January, 2022. I'm Conal O'Moran. As always, the business stories, tips, hacks, and insights on this podcast are brought to you courtesy of our tip-top sponsor, DeFacto Shaving Solution. It looks like we'll be traveling again. You don't need any hassle at airport security with shaving foam cans. That's why nail varnish sized DeFacto is your ideal traveling companion. Get it now on DeFactoShave.com.
It's all go, let Chrissy know on thatgreatbusinessshow.com.
And we're starting today with a simple business quiz. Just one question and see if you can guess the answer. You're a concert promoter. You've secured a top international act to play at Dublin's Three Arena, where the capacity is 9,000 seats per night. Your act is doing two nights at an average ticket price of €90. Now, I'm going to make this really easy by doing some of the maths for you. 2 times 9,000 multiplied by 90 gives you gross ticket sales of €1.62 million. And here's the question. How much do you think the promoter makes out of that? Well, you're going to learn anything and everything about the music business in Ireland in the next hour. You see, the answer to my question is on page 216 of a new book called Backstage Pass, a memoir written by legendary music promoter Pat Egan. So who better to answer the question than the man himself, a man who has brought Elton John, Bob Marley, Queen, George Michael, Eric Clapton, Billy Connolly, and so many more to Ireland. Pat Egan, welcome to That Great Business Show. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
You are a legend.
I think the word is a bit overused in the last, certainly in the last 20, 30 years. I think all the legends really lived in the 60s and the early 70s, the Beatles and the Roy Orbisons and people. I don't think today's modern stars are legends or will become legends. Maybe the odd one.
You told me you weren't going to be cranky. That sounds cranky.
I'm not. I just pretty much like to say what's on my mind, and it gets me into all kinds of hot water, or has done in the past.
Well, your first thing that you're going to do is answer that riddle or that question. Gross sales, €1.62 million. How much top ends can you make out of that as a promoter?
Well, at that level, the highest level, you're probably working on a 5% of the net, and you're guaranteeing 90% or 80% of the net to the artist.
So that's 55,000 quid, and you also have to guarantee, what was it, 750,000?
Well, you'd be guaranteeing possibly 80% of the potential net amount after the venue and the various costs.
Now,
running
like
the show.
Like yourself, I have a little bit of a business background. So if I was putting up 750,000, hoping to make 55,000, I wouldn't call that business. I'd call that gambling.
It is a form of gambling, but it's, you see, when you have a red hot act, there is no gamble involved. And therefore, the artist and the management of the artist and the artist's accountants have discovered, well, they probably discovered it a long time ago, but they've discovered that, why do we need a promoter and why are we paying him so much money? So we'll give him as little as possible just to keep. So you're really, it's the gamble takes place when you have an artist that you're not 100% sure is going to do that kind of level of business, 100% business. All the big acts, the really big acts are pretty much guaranteed, especially in Ireland more so than other countries, of doing 100% business. So
why in Ireland?
It's just there's an enormous appetite in Ireland and has been. You can see that by the number of festivals that are run here for such a small population compared with countries that have three times the population, four times the population. There's just an enormous appetite in Ireland for rock music or contemporary music and pop music of all sorts.
And country music, Garth Brooks.
And country music too. I forgot about him. Yes.
Does that astound you?
A very, very unique artist and... You know, when you look and you add up the figures and you think there's 400,000 people going to see this man. And I don't think Elvis would have got 400,000 people. He might if he came back, but...
if he came back, he'd probably have more than 400,000 people that if he looked for the secret.
No, but it's a phenomenal thing, the Garth Brooks thing. And
what's that about, though?
Please God, it will all go ahead this year. There won't be any COVIDs or other thing. I think Peter Aiken deserves to get his substantial payday, having taken such a battering on the last couple of years with it, you know.
I can read when in the book, I can see that Peter Aiken is a pal of yours. You say nice things about him.
No, he's not Peter Aiken. I know Peter. He's a gentleman, and I talk to him, and... he is a very, very private kind of operator, but he, and there's no flash involved, if you know what I mean. So, but I wouldn't call him a friend. I know him all right, but.
Does that mean that you've had business rivalry, real business
rivalry? No, there's no business rivalry. Peter and the other operators in Ireland, Dennis Desmond, operate on a far different level. I backed off that years ago because of, I probably didn't have the guts in a lot of cases, you know. And the earlier days, you were allowed to make money. You operated on a... When I started off with Billy Connolly, I was on an 80-20. When I finished with Billy Connolly, I was on a 97.5-7.5 split. So over the years, the promoter split has disappeared, really. The real money has disappeared. It's very hard to make 100 grand on a show in the Three Arena now. That probably all started. It started, I think, in the 70s with Led Zeppelin's manager, Peter Grant, who basically said, what are we paying these promoters money for? We'll do a 95.5 or a 92.5, 7.5. And I did it in the early days with Van Morrison when Paul Charles was the agent. He did a 95.5 with me on Van Morrison. So it goes way back. And it's just now it has become, as I said, the big acts will make the money, the smaller acts. It's very difficult now for middle-of-the-road acts, ones that are doing 1,000 people or 1,500 people, to make money. The costs are just, and the pandemic has, the costs in all the theatres in town, the rent in the Olympia has jumped enormously, the rent in Vicar Street has jumped enormously, but you can't. The problem is those venues are promoter-owned. They're owned and run by promoters, which means that there isn't any room for independent guys to slip in there. Because of all the cancellations and the rescheduling, they have more acts than they can handle now, and not enough venues or not enough nights or whatever.
Which brings me neatly to a subject maybe that you don't really want to talk about, but it's chapter 27 that you call the Pyramid of Greed Cartels.
I think that's a quote that came from an American. I didn't come up with that. It's relates to enormous companies like Live Nation and McDonald's and all those big international.
Because what people don't realize about Live Nation is they own the venues, they own Ticketmaster, they own the acts that they have, I think, about 500 acts under their belt. I was reading their annual report yesterday because that's the kind of thing I do. They have an interest in, I think I read, 50,000 venues worldwide. It is an enormous company. That makes an enormous amount of money, that paid its chief executive $70 million in 2017. So it makes a lot of money.
It's a different league from anything that I was ever involved with. I started off when a lot of the stuff was, you know, it was new territory. Bands came in the 70s, the early bands that came in from the UK in the 70s, you made money and you made good money. You made as much money out of the gig as they did. But that doesn't happen anymore. So the whole Live Nation thing, I mean, was it developed over a number of years. It was originally, I think, called SFX in America, and then it developed into an entertainment company. Originally, they were doing some, I think they were doing movies and stuff and that kind of thing, music thing. But they basically went into the venue operation and bought out an awful lot of promoters across the world. Big promoters who were turning over big books. I think Peter Aiken is probably the one independent promoter who has managed to compete with them at their own game in terms of the quality of what he presents.
I'm not asking you to say this because I'll say it for you. They are, I suppose the jargon is vertically integrated, but you could say that they own maybe too much. And now it is, ironically, this week that I'm talking to you, it's being challenged in the Californian courts. They've reinstituted a claim about competition and about monopoly and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, the problem in Dublin is that, and any promoter, and there are very few, that's the other thing, of course, there are very few promoters left in Ireland, independent promoters. And you can't start a new business as a concert promoter. It just doesn't work like that. So if you want to hire a theatre in Dublin, in the centre of Dublin, for instance, the Olympia, the Gaiety, the Academy, which is a gig, 500, 600 capacity gig, you want to go to the Bord Gáis or you want to go to the Dre Arena. They're all managed or owned by Live Nation. So you can't put on any kind of a stage show in Dublin where you need a big production wise without going to Live Nation. Years ago, I could go to the Gaiety, and if they were asking for too much, I could go to the Olympia. And there was a variety, and you had choices. There are no choices anymore. I mean, the other end of the business that you spoke about there is way out of what anything that I do. I'm just a kind of working man's promoter or whatever. You know, I will still run gigs. That is why I did a deal late last year with the UCD in Belfield to use a hall, a terrific hall, the O'Reilly Hall, which they use for a lot of various occasions, but they still have it. It's not getting used to its full capacity. So I had a number of meetings with them, and they were delighted the fact that the type of show I wanted to put on, which is very middle of the road audience, and they were happy with that. So they did a deal with me where I would present up to 100 shows, 50 to 100 shows a year in the O'Reilly Hall. So that gave me I could walk away from the cartel, as you call it, and do something on my own.
But that is what you're good at, though, because you keep on spotting market opportunities, because you're being a bit modest. You did do, if I remember correctly, the first big festivals or the first big stadium events in Ireland, correct?
Well, there were one or two before I did it. I did Status Quo in Dalymount Park in 1979, in I think it's 77 or 78. Thin Lizzy played there with Graham Parker and The Rumour and things.
And that wasn't you, no?
Bob Marley in 1980 was the first big superstar had to come in. But Queen had come in the year before into the Simmons Court, which again was a first. The Simmons Court had never been used before. It wasn't built for music, but it had the capacity. And to put on a band like Queen, because they had always had enormous stage productions, you needed a big venue. So I took a gamble. I was in partnership. Oliver Barry, who is well known in the entertainment business, was a silent partner with me for many years, and a great, terrific man, and a great leveler in terms of my doing things. When I was young, I was a bit, you know, I'd fly off the handle a bit in terms of doing stuff that I shouldn't do. Oliver would always say, "Stop, Pat, wait, there's another opportunity coming up next week or whatever."
What kind of thing might you have done?
No, I would take gambles on things, or, you know, when I was opening record shops, I would want to go into a shop where Oliver would say the rent is too much there, let them sit on it for a month or two and it'll still be there or whatever, and you can always go back. So you learn from experience is, you know, in hindsight, it's a terrific thing. So I was very lucky with having Oliver there in terms of guiding me. And I went into the Simmons Court when no one else was going in there. I went to Dalymount Park with a big show way ahead of what's there now. And there were opportunities then where there weren't as many restrictions as there are now. There's an awful lot of restrictions now. If you're doing any kind of an outdoor show, the amount of attention to detail in terms of complying with licenses and health and safety issues and everything else is ginormous. It costs an awful lot of money. It didn't happen that way in Daly Mount. There was no health and safety. There was no application to the court. There was nothing. There was a dropped into Mountjoy police station, as I said in the book. I dropped into Mountjoy police station 10 days before the concert in Daly Mount Park, and the sergeant at the desk took out a big book and he said, "How many are you expecting?" And I said, "About 20,000. He said, "Oh my God, that many." So that was how it was.
Hang on, what else did he ask you for?
Well, as I was just leaving, he just said to me, "Will there be a few tickets for the lads?" Which, of course, there was a few tickets for the lads, because that's how things were done at that time. But anyway, it was just that you saw what happened in Crow Park with so many times. I mean, in Daly Mount, that didn't happen. There might have been one or two complaints from residents, but we finished our shows really at 7 o'clock. So they were afternoon in the park is what they were called.
But you've just been telling me that Live Nation and others control all your great venues. But surely that there are those other venues, the RDS, there's the Sims Court being RDS, was the Daly Mount, Aviva, there must be there.
There is, but you see, you can't get the artists of that. You know, if you want a Taylor Swift or you want any of those big acts, and you wouldn't want Taylor Swift because she didn't do the business when she did come in before. But acts of that caliber, they're all now controlled from the States. I think there's another big company called AIG or AEG. I'm not sure.
AEG, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then there are people in England that I have dealt with in the past, AAA and people like that. And they're still connected in some way with the Live Nation cartel or whatever. So I have to take risks now in terms of getting a big payday. You'd get an artist who might have been big 20 years ago, like I did one a few years ago with Julio Iglesias, and he wanted a flat fee. And flat fees are always good because they're not interested in what your profit is. They don't ask you for all the details up front in advance. And Julio Iglesias, who had been an enormous star, wanted $250,000, and it looked like a good bet. So I hired the Tree Arena, hoping to sell 9,000 tickets at 80 quid a go or whatever, but he only sold 3,000 and something tickets. So I took a hit of about 185,000 quid.
Oh, jeez, that's sore.
But that was part of the gamble. And that is why, if you're running any kind of an entertainment company and running any kind of shows, you have to have a few bob in the bank. People don't always understand that. They look at your, you know, won't go into that part of it. But anyway,
that's the bit we all want to hear. Go back to Julio. Why didn't that work?
He had passed his sell-by date.
Okay, all right.
He didn't have that. He was a kind of he was a Hollywood star, first of all, in terms of music. You know, he was a glossy kind of guy, and he didn't write his own songs. He wasn't a Bruce Springsteen or whatever it was. But there are people like that, like Rod Stewart, who hasn't written too many songs, who have managed to maintain that kind of reinventing themselves over and over, and, you know, getting themselves into a little bit of trouble just to keep in the news and that kind of thing. And people...
Never really?
Wild Boy and that kind of thing. They like it, you know?
About that, about the your chosen act, where used you... Obviously, things have moved on. Where used you might look for them? Because obviously other people were chasing them as well.
Well, in the 70s, and certainly in the 70s and right up into the 80s, I would go to London on a regular basis once every month or so, and I'd go around the different agents see what was happening. You'd look at the chart and you'd see a band were starting to break. And the great thing about having a record shop was you got a great feel from the punters who came in, because they were all very well into their music. You know, I had guys like Dave Fanning and various other people that...
People called Conall O'Moran used to go into your shop as well.
Very often. Well, you see, you were dealing with, you had to know your music, first of all, because you people that were coming in were experts. They could tell you who the bass player on such and such an album was and all that kind of stuff, who the producer was. So they knew their music. So that was a great plus in terms of booking artists for concerts, dealing with the public every Saturday, you know.
Well, let me come back to the record store in a second, because first of all, we have to take a quick short break. And remember, these great business insights are brought to you, as always, by De Facto, the world's best shaving oil. Get it at defactoshave.com.
Thinking of travel? If so, make sure to make De Facto, the world's best shaving oil, your choice of travel companion. A 25 milliliter bottle of De Facto means no hassle at airports, no bulky cans to carry, and the guarantee of the world's best shave. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Subscribe today to That Great Business Show on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple and Spotify.
I'm here with super promoter Pat Egan, chatting away about the music industry, past, present and future. And one of the things that we were just about to talk about was the record stores, because anybody who knows of Pat Egan will remember Pat Egan's Sound Cellar on Nassau Street in Dublin, which was an institution.
It's still in existence. Tommy Tye, who worked with me there at the very beginning, took it over from me about 10 years after I opened it, which would have been around 1980. And he is still, his daughter works with him now, Sarah, and he is still operating 52 years on. In a basement shop right on the corner of Grafton Street, which the original rent was £3 a week. I was probably turning over about 150 quid a week on albums at the beginning, because you have to remember an album was only 1.99 or less in those days. It's a real, credit to and a terrific achievement that such a record store, an underground progressive music store, should still be in existence 52 years after it opened.
And is it primarily living on vinyl?
There'd be a lot. I haven't been in to see Tommy for a while. The COVID has kind of put a halt on my running around town. There'd be a lot of vinyl as it's again picking up traction across the whole.
It is picking up, but really, it's still teeny.
It's still a specialist, though. Yeah, it's very much a specialist. CDs have picked up, I think, in the last year or two, and even cassettes now are back.
CDs, I have millions of them. Anybody want them? I want to get rid of them.
Yeah, well, nobody wants them.
Exactly. Not even the charity shops, believe it or not. They say go away. The future of music like that, what's the future that you're thinking of? Because obviously, again, you've been at this a long time and you've seen it turn over and going this way and that way and this way and that way. What's the future?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, and then... when you get to 75, you don't want to give up a business that you've been in all your life. And I just don't know actually where it's going to go from here. In terms of my own thing, I just like to run middle market shows and stuff like that, because I know there's an audience there for them. For young people, radio, because it's dwindling in terms of age as well. And when I say dwindling in terms of age, I mean people of, up to 20, 25 even don't listen to the radio. It's very hard to know where it's going. I do think there may be a rebirth of radio, all right, for
do
young
you?
People.
Do yeah, you really. Yeah.
But it's getting your music played on the radio. The problem we have since the internet took over the world is that the biggest problem an artist has these days is to get people to listen to their music. There's just, everybody wants to be a star. Everybody is a star. And you can become a star, as we've seen. So everybody, it's a bit like buying a lotto ticket. People who can't sing and can't write and can't dance are out there trying to become stars as well. And I don't know whether we'll get any long-term acts, you know, long-term stars the way we did with Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan's and these great, great artists. I don't know whether that's ever going to remain as it is.
Which is, I was thinking about something along the same lines and wondering, maybe you've got out of the big concerts at the right time and that Live Nation and others will be stuffed because these big concerts won't happen anymore. And now, and I'm not asking you to even think about going there, but down the Mark Zuckerberg road of Metaverse, where we'll all be wearing headgear and going to a concert, that you won't be going down to Daily Mount Park, you won't be going to the Aviva or anywhere. You'll just sit in your front room and stick on a pair of goggles.
Well, you could well be doing that. I have no idea because I don't keep up to date with that. So that's one of the reasons that I feel, you know, talking about today's market is not something I'm an expert in. If you'd have asked me these questions 30 years ago, I could answer all those kind of things. But
and
now,
would you have been right? In other words, were you good at forecasting?
I was good at knowing in advance that something would sell.
Except for Julio.
Well, there's a lot of Julios. I've probably had three or four artists, not in terms of that size of a loss, but I've had other concerts that I did, and I did an outdoor I did an outdoor gig a few years back on the pier in Dunleary called Proms at the Pier. That was the idea, and it was a middle market one again. The trouble with mature music fans is that they're very, very fussy. You know, they don't like any sort of discomfort, and you're asking them to buy a ticket for 3 months down the road or 2 months down the road when it might, well, the rain might be just, you know, unbelievable kind of. And they don't want to buy things unless they're sure. Unlike the younger generation, there was a gig on the pier that night or two before us, some kind of a rave or something, which did great business. The younger kids will come out regardless of what the thing is. So in terms of what you say about going forward, and I have no idea what it's going to change, of course, because everything is changing. Where things changed over a 5-year period or 10-year period in the 70s and 80s are now changing over in 6 months. So I have no idea.
Okay, well, that's pretty forthright and straightforward. I'm actually really interested in what you just said there about radio, though. Do you honestly think that people are going to have listen to radio again when you can listen to, we're kind of talking about Spotify and all these, why would you bother? Who wants to listen to a DJ?
Well, I'm not sure that younger people now, in terms of music interests and things, are really getting the full picture. They get what they want. They're not getting any kind of, there's no, you know, years ago you had John Peel and you had Dave Fanning and these guys who would enlighten you into what was happening or whatever. I suppose nowadays what's happening is all based on the number you. It's not, a record company won't sign an artist now based on their talent, on their songwriting talents. They'll only base it on the numbers of followers they have online. So the more followers you have online, whether you have any talent or not, the more likely it is you'll get a deal of some sort.
But are you being a wee bit nostalgic? Because some people now, okay, forget about the Beatles, they were extraordinary. But there must have been hundreds of bad acts that just happened to be either good-looking fellas, good-looking girls, whatever. 100 years ago now, I'm talking about the 1960s, 70s, 80s.
There were pop bands at the time, you know, like the Archies and the Sugar Cubes and Not Sugar Cubes. Forget the name of them. Sugar Cubes are a band that I work with now. They'd be horrified to think that I said they were.
The Sugar Babes, maybe?
Eugene McCarthy is the MD in the Sugar Cubes, and he's a great guy.
The Sugar Babes?
No. Sugar Baby Love. That was the. I've lost the thing. You've caught me. But I think always bad bands and bad music. I mean, we had show bands in Ireland for years and years, and, you know, out of the 200 show bands or whatever that worked every weekend or whatever, there were probably three or four that had real talent. The rest of them were tree chord merchants. And unfortunately, they're out there now in disguise as country acts now as well.
That's another phenomenon, is that I look at TV and I see these bands or singers. Where does this audience come from, particularly in Northern Ireland?
Yes, Northern Ireland's it's a big country market. It always has been, but it's not country either. It's a mishmash of you know, country, American country songs, poorly performed. And, you know, I mean, some of them, those people, they really should be arrested, you know, because it's awful stuff. But unfortunately, there is an audience for it. And who am I to say people shouldn't enjoy whatever music it is they
fancy?
And
there's a market there, and you're not actually trying to make some money out of it.
No, it's not a market that I would be interested in. You know, I did one or two. I have a very good relationship with Sandy Kelly, and I did some shows with her a year ago. But I felt that, and I think this is indicative of what's happened. Sandy Kelly was probably the best Irish country female artist that we ever had. She went to Nashville at a time when no one would go there. She managed to record with Willie Nelson, with Johnny Cash, with loads of people or whatever. But when she came home to Ireland, her talent was not recognised. Yet you had people like Margot and Susan McCann and all these other girls who couldn't sing in tune getting awards from the Irish Country Music Association or whatever. And, you know, I'm sure Daniel O'Donnell is a really lovely man. I'm told he is. But really, you know, RTE goes to town on Daniel O'Donnell week after week. If it's not his 60th birthday, he's gone off around the country with his missus doing whatever he does, but he can't sing, you know.
Would you love to run RTE?
No, I wouldn't, not because I wouldn't be capable of it. But in terms of the music, I mean, RTE doesn't play country music, Irish country music either, to be fair to the country people or whatever. They don't. They get the exposure on a few stations like Highland and Shannon and a few of those, give them a lot of exposure. And then, of course, those stations are involved with local country promotion. So it's a business deal rather than a choice to play country music.
So what's RTE2FM about?
Well, I don't listen to 2FM, although I did an interview there last week with Dave Fanning, and it was amazing to sit in the studio with him. And he is just as enthusiastic about all the new bands. He knew a name of, he knows all what's going on or whatever, and I give him great credit for that. But I just, I couldn't keep up with all that stuff now. When you get into business and you're running a business or whatever, and then you get married, you have children, you have all the home things, other things start taking a priority over the...
But you're meant to keep your finger on the pulse as to what people are listening to, and
No, not really anymore. I would be telling a lie if I said that. I have no idea. I mean, I obviously watch the television, RTE television. There's some really good RTE radio and television. Radio 1 doesn't play enough music. It just doesn't have the space for it. But they do play new Irish acts, Ronan Collins and people like that. The television they're doing some terrific stuff on the television, you know.
I saw in the book that one of my own heroes, that your name checked him, Ken Stewart. He was fantastic.
Well, he was way ahead of his time in the 60s. He was, and I think that was because he was a journalist as well as just a radio man, and he was writing about what was happening in America. He was the correspondent for Billboard magazine in Ireland when Billboard meant an awful lot, more so than it does now. And he did bring music to RTE Radio 1 in the late 60s and 70s that nobody else was playing. BP Fallon probably followed on after that and played a lot of stuff too that no one else was playing. So, you know, you need someone like that in a radio station, that someone that has a broad view of everything and can tell you what's happening or whatever.
What would you do with 2FM if it appears, because there are many, many complaints about this, that they don't seem to support music from Ireland? I won't call it Irish music from Ireland.
Well, the problem is that I think 2FM probably uses it more so than any of the commercial stations. The difficulty is for artists is to get a rotation airplay. If you have a song out, getting it played once or twice a week or even three times a week is no good, really. You need that old, what used to happen in the in the days of Radio Caroline in Luxembourg or whatever, where you got a new song came out and it was going to be a hit and it was played 20, 30 times a week. And that's what...
The power play.
Exactly, a power play, the very thing. There are no power plays anymore.
I didn't know about you until I read the book that you actually broadcast with Radio Caroline.
Well, North. I think broadcast is probably not the right word for it. I was on Radio Caroline North. I went out there from Dublin where I was making good money in the clubs in those days playing records. And I went out there when they brought in the Marine Offences Law, which stopped all the UK citizens working on the ships. And I spent a period there of 3 weeks, and I didn't go back after that.
But that was partly seasickness, was it?
Partly which?
Seasickness. I think you said
there was
terrible.
An element of seasickness, but there was also an element of... I've always found it hard sitting in front of a microphone in an empty room, as I do when somebody puts a television camera or something in front of me as well. I always found that very hard. I could get up on a stage in front of 5,000 people, but I couldn't. I find it difficult even to this day because I just don't. It's not me.
It's funny, isn't it? And you seem like it's completely normal.
Yeah, well, it is sometimes, but,
Do you find this hard now?
Hmm?
Do you find this hard, chatting to me?
Not especially, because I think there's the element here is that there's a little bit of time to do it properly. In a lot of the interviews and things that you do, you know, when I was doing stuff for the book, there'd be people who ring me from morning programs and things that Anya Carmody had set up for me. And it had all happened in kind of 2.5 minutes, so you didn't even get a chance to relax or to get across what you wanted to.
Actually, speaking of Anya, she'll kill me if we don't talk about the book in a second, but let me just take a quick break and remember these great stories from Paddy Egan are made possible by our sponsor, DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil. Get it at defactoshave.com.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
That Great Business Show.
I'm with Pat Egan, the promoter, who is promoting his book. And the book is called Backstage Pass, and it's an aid of St. Auden's School. That's where you went to school, wasn't it?
No, I didn't. Sorry. I had an office on Merchant's Quay for 33 years. In fact, it only closed up since the pandemic came in. I moved to a smaller office because it just wasn't viable anymore. At the back of Merchant's Quay, there is a national school called St. Audience, which is it's an underprivileged school. And I got involved with them a good few years ago, trying to add a little bit of joy to the lives of the kids. We had I gave them a grand piano, and we had an in-house band and stuff like that for the kids. So
did you sign any of them up?
We didn't sign any of them. No, I'm not into signing up business. Promoters didn't sign up people, you know.
You might have spotted a new U2 or something.
Yes, yeah. No, I missed a new U2 once, all right.
Did you?
But I wouldn't have been a manager in those days anyway.
But did you?
Well,
I gave them
a gig way back in 1987, was it?
Oh, come on, everybody claims that they were, you know, they spotted U2.
Yes. Well, no, I didn't. I did the gig. They came in, one of them, Larry Mullen, came into the record shop, and he knew I was running the Stranglers out on the Top Hat in Dunleary, and he was looking to see if we had a support act, and we didn't have a support act. And I told him there was 50 quid in it. He really didn't care about the 50 quid. He just wanted to do the gig. So they opened.
Good for him. That's good.
They opened for the Stranglers in Dunleary, which was jammed to the door, about 2,000 plus people. And I was more interested in, you know, making sure that we got everybody in and took their money off them rather than look at the Support Act. But I probably wouldn't have got involved at that point anyway, because I probably wasn't smart enough to be a really good manager. And really good managers are very hard to find. And they were extremely lucky to come up with Paul McGuinness.
The book is gorgeous for a couple of reasons. It probably suits a person like me because you use it to settle a few scores. Talk to me about the National Concert Hall.
The National Concert Hall is a terrific venue run by the Arts Council or the Arts the State, whatever it is. It's a terrific hall. It's got great facilities, and I worked there for 20-something years, running up to 25, 30 shows a year, which I enjoyed immensely. And there are some terrific people up there that I miss not working with them now, because I do very few shows there compared to what I did years ago. And
you name check those people as well, which gave me a little bit of a smile as well, because obviously you didn't name some of the other people.
Well, no, there were the management of the hall. I had a very good relationship with the previous management of the hall, run by a lady called Judith Woodward, who is well known in the arts fraternity. And the new management took over. They basically changed the music programming and whatever. And I was just very upset, because in 2018. I had requested dates for various weekends and whenever I could get them or whatever. But the hall was closed in 2018 for 101 nights.
That's mad.
Well, the business was there, but they didn't want it, basically.
But why?
Well, it didn't suit the new idea. They had a new management team in place, and they had new plans for the hall. And they were entitled to have all the plans that they wanted.
Do you see this paragraph in the book? Is that was this a letter written to you?
No, that was, I was called into the hall after I made a number of complaints about the fact that the hall wasn't being operated, what I felt, in a business-like fashion. I made a number of complaints to the hall. They ignored me, and I went public with them, and I was basically called in and put on the red carpet in front of the chief executive at the time and a couple of other people, and told that
I'll quote what you were told: it's none of your business. You can now take your place at the back of the queue like any other promoter.
Well, I had a very good deal in the hall, because I was running so many shows, and that deal was put in place previous with the previous managing director of the hall, or the CEO. And I was very happy with that, and I was happy to run the shows we did. And at that time, the hall was very, very keen to bring in more Dublin people into the hall, more middle-class working people into the hall, because it was seen as a bit of an aloof place, and there was an element of snobbery involved in it and whatever. And they were very keen to bring in, open it up a bit, whatever, which
and
I
what
did.
What you did, you put on Mario Lanza, you put on Maria Callas, you put on...
Well, they were crossover shows, which I got some support on those or whatever from other people. The Mario Lanza one I did with a lady called Geraldine McCann, who was... who ran the Mario Lanza Society in Ireland for a long number of years. Lanza was an enormous talent, but he was a bit like, dare I say it, Garth Brooks, in the sense that people absolutely adored him at that time in the 60s. And it was either Elvis or Mario Lanza were the big stars. So the lady, Geraldine, approached me about his centenary, not a centenary, his 50th, I think, anniversary. And we put on a show, and it was an enormous success. We ran it 14 or 15 times, taking in 15,000 people or whatever overall. We went to the Wexford Opera House with it, and Cork Opera House, and Limerick or whatever, and it was an enormous success. It's hard for people to understand today how popular Lanza was in Ireland. I think it was probably songs like, you know, I Walk With God and those big ballads at the time. And Radio Éireann at that time, of course, they loved Lanza as well. So he was played almost every day on the radio, maybe even more than Elvis was.
But did I see on your website that you are continuing with that? Have you got dates in for 2022?
There's a date in the National Concert Hall for the end of this year, which has been booked
which is
for a long
2022.
Time.
Yeah.
Please God, those dates will come. But I intend to run a lot of shows like that if we can get back to normal and I can pull this deal together in Belfield. Because there is no concert venue on the south side of the city. I mean, you can go to Dunleary; they have a terrific little theatre there, but it only takes the pavilion. It only takes 300 people or so, and you can't make money on 300 people. You know, if you're Christy Moore, you can make money on 300 people or 3,000 because you're just a man with a guitar. But so the plan is to put a lot of shows in there for the part of the market that is at this point basically ignored. There's nothing happening for people over 40 or 50. If you don't like, you know, Christy Moore or Paul Brady, there's very little else for you.
Well, of course, it's not either or. You can like them both and your stuff as well. Yeah. So who are you going to put into? I had
intended to open in April. And Paul Brady had agreed to do the first gig for me. So I'd be going for artists like that. I was hoping Colm Wilkinson, who's a friend of mine, was going to do a gig. He doesn't do that many gigs anymore, but he still sells out. We were doing various other shows. We had the Nelson Riddle Orchestra, which is Nelson Riddle's son, coming in to do a big Sinatra night. We also had Rat Pack Night, the show that we took in from London. And we were doing a couple of spiritual concerts, Padre Pio. We were doing a celebration of Padre Pio with the big spiritual nights or whatever, because there's a big audience there for it. And I know, and the money, of course, for that wasn't going to Pat Egan. It was being run for the Church Street Day Center or whatever, where Padre Pio is the patron saint or whatever of the Capuchins.
How many can you get into the O'Reilly Hall in
UCD? You can
get
in 1,000 people.
1,000?
1,000.
Yeah.
So you can make money in the O'Reilly Hall if you get your numbers right. It also has an awful lot going for it in the sense that there's a terrific car park there because of the fact that it's university, and when the concerts are on, the car parks are pretty much empty. It has a terrific new restaurant in the UCD club there, which is part of the hall. It has bars, obviously, and there's a bus which stops right out at the front gates as well. And that side of the city, as I said, you know, has an enormous number of people, must be close to 1 million people living on the south side there. And there is no proper venue for them.
And you don't know this about the O'Reilly Hall. It's a beautiful hall, designed by my brother.
Was it?
Yeah, there you go. It's a beautiful hall, I have to say.
Yes, it's not a venue suitable for running our Christmas panto and all that kind of stage stuff. As I said, there's only a few theatres in Dublin where you can stage that type of production, but it is a good concert hall, and I have every confidence that it was going to work. It's just we were going to call it the Concert Zone at the UCD, which to give it a kind of identity of its own. Because one of the problems when you're running the kind of concerts that I am, where you have to create an audience, if I decide we're going to do a Carpenter show or whatever, which we have done a terrific Carpenter show, but if I've got, so I have to create that audience for that show. I have to go out and drag them in. It's not like easy stuff where, you know, you put a Bruce Springsteen show on sale and it flies out overnight. So what I was doing was that trying to develop, create, you were selling not just the concert, but you were selling a new venue as well. And I know there's an awful lot of people on the south side would know the O'Reilly Hall and had been there. So it was an opportunity that I probably wouldn't get anywhere else.
Do you know what they were using it for very recently? Vaccines. I got myself vaxxed there.
They were?
They were. And they got far more than 1,000 people in as well.
Yes. Well, you'd probably get in a lot more people, but these...
Would you be allowed to have a standing audience there? Now, I'm not suggesting that you want to, but just
well,
would
no,
you?
They were... Part of the thing was the reason that they actually approached me was that they wanted what they call kind of quality shows. They didn't want the students coming in and whatever because
I love students, that place. They don't want students in.
No, the students have their own venue there.
Well, they actually don't anymore.
Do have some kind of hall.
Oh, it's a long story, but I used to promote concerts in UCD once upon a time. Did you know that?
When it was
in the Terrace? No, God, no. No, in the restaurant in UCD. I was unfortunately there at the time of the murder. I was in charge of the night of the murder. So yeah. I have a little bit of a background in there as well. Anyway, that's only by here and there.
No,
won't happen at your Mario Lanza.
But they were, yes, it's that type of show, Mario Lanza, Maria Callas, along with the, you know, the popular artists of the thing. And I mean, some of those, you know, people kind of, you'll get people turning their nose up at tribute shows or whatever. But I have seen tribute shows and lucky to be involved with a few. There was a girl called Belinda Davis from South Africa who sang at the one of the big rugby matches there. I saw her on the thing. She does a greatest love of all Whitney Houston show. And it's just absolutely out of this world. Brilliant. I mean, there's a young guy from Australia. He's not that young now, but he's a guy from Australia called Dean Bourne who does Roy Orbison or whatever. And again, it's just stunning. It's very hard to sing, you know.
So you see, you are keeping your finger on the pulse because you actually have to go out and find out about these people.
Well, you do, but sometimes they're offered to you because the bigger guys, you see, Peter Aiken and Dennis Desmond, they will do, to fill up dates in their theatres and their places, they will take in tribute shows, but they don't actually promote tribute shows. I mean, why would you bother promoting an Elton John tribute show if the man himself is available to you? And that's one of the things about tributes is that the artist really needs to be dead. That you're, you know, I mean,
no problem.
Because people will go along and they'll sing ABBA songs or whatever. But ABBA, you know, other than the album which they brought out recently, haven't done anything for
you. But did you see what they're going to do? They're going to do this 3D thingy
they are,
or whatever
that
it is.
People are funny. They'll go to a good tribute artist. And good tribute artists, you know, it makes me laugh sometimes. They make movies and they have, you know, they did one on Tina Turner. They've done it on various other artists as well. Some terrific ones, Ray Charles and people like that or whatever. And people will get awards, whether it be Academy Awards or Golden Globes or whatever it is, for their portrayal of so-and-so in a movie. Yet you have probably, I can name 6 or 8 tribute acts, international ones, and 1 or 2 Irish ones, that are actually doing the same thing on the stage without all that tech support that you get making a movie and producing performances that are absolutely stunning recreations of the original artist.
I had forgotten until you just mentioned their ABBA. I'm wondering, when is that going to happen? Do you know? That is coming our way.
I read about it, all right. Yeah. It was before the album or whatever it was, and I'm sure that it will come, but it still won't be the same.
But it's the future. And therefore...
No, I don't think it's the future that way. I don't think that's one bit of the future that I don't think I would never... Well, it may be for people who weren't lucky enough to be around to see some of the artists. But I don't think artists who are still alive will get away with sending out some kind of hologram of themselves around the world. I think the reason that they put those ones out, I went to the Roy Orbison one, and while the voice and the music... He had done a big thing with the London Symphony Orchestra. They had re-recorded his stuff. This guy from Australia, Dean Bourne, was with a 6-piece band. And he not only, you see, with tribute artists, a lot of them like to, they want to recreate the visual image as well as the musical part of it. But the music is really the important bit. And if you're singing Roy Orbison and you can't sing it properly, there's nowhere to hide, you know. You have to be good, really good. And this chap was absolutely brilliant, as was the girl who does Karen Carpenter. We have that show in the Bord Gáis in March. I don't know whether it'll happen or not now. And she's an English girl called Tony Lee, and she reproduces Karen Carpenter's voice almost to a T. It's just incredible. She has that smoky, low tone and things. It works a treat. So don't dismiss all the tribute artists as being... you know.
Oh, I don't dismiss them.
No, no, but you get bands, you know, you go somewhere, especially if you're
if
at
like
a wedding.
Me with Pink Floyd. Unfortunately, Pink Floyd.
The Australians have been very good at leading the field in terms of tribute acts. The Australian Pink Floyd, and has now been copied by the English Pink Floyd as well, of course. Yeah. And, I mean, they're terrific shows. And for people who weren't around to see them, Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin or whatever, I don't think there's any big tribute Led Zeppelin bands. There are some, of course.
Now, do you know what? The start of this, before we started, you said to me that you probably wouldn't be able to sustain an hour. Well, do you know what? You've done more than an hour, and you're not even finished yet.
And I have my lovely wife, Felina, is waiting down below for me.
I made sure that you knew this, is that you are going to be asked, who would Pat Egan, Uber promoter, hire in a heartbeat?
At 75, I'd prefer somebody would hire me in a heartbeat because I could do it a job now where someone else is taking the risk or whatever. Now, there are a few people that have worked with me over the years, and I had a poster business in Dublin, which for the last 33 years, which has unfortunately, due to the COVID and lots of other things, has come to an end.
Is it ended?
Yes. The posters that you see in around town won't be there anymore, which were a service to the live business, and they were very much a part of the thing. So I've had a chap working there called Garrett Delaney, named Garrett Delaney, for the last 20-something years, who has done an incredible job. I'd hire him tomorrow again if I could. And I have a lady who's been working with me for 20-something years too, Caroline O'Neill. And again, without her, I couldn't keep the place going. So there's two people that I would hire in a flash, but I still would like a job somewhere else if somebody would pay me 150 grand a year.
Not
or whatever.
At all. You'd be too, wouldn't be happy.
I would be very happy.
You get such a thrill. You're going to fill the O'Reilly Hall. How many gigs will you do now over, say, the coming year?
Well, I can't do any. I was talking to them only yesterday and they understand completely. I said I would like to put some shows on sale for the autumn, but the problem is that once you put the show out there, you're committing a sizable amount of money. The acts are flexible because of the COVID and all that. But that age audience, over 40s audience, won't come out in numbers and be crammed into a 1,000-seater hall altogether as long as the COVID is out there. And that's the problem. So I can't, even though I had booked people for it, now I've got to knock it on the head. I have to wait till the COVID is gone.
Such a pain. Such a pain. Hopefully, and I am really hopeful of this now, is we may be seeing the back end of it now. And that might be in a month's time. Maybe we'll see the back end of it. Yeah. Pat Egan, it has been the first time I've ever met you. It's been a complete pleasure. And I know that we could probably keep going for another hour or two. Oh, better give Anya Carmody a big shout out for that book. It is called Backstage Pass, A Life in Show Business, Pat Egan, forward by Billy Connolly. We didn't even touch on Billy Connolly, but I did that deliberately. We wanted to talk strictly business. And I can't even see how much it is. But what is it, about 20 euros?
It's 17 quid, I think.
Okay. And all of it, I think, goes to St. Auden's School.
Well, all my royalties, which are probably not a lot, but they'll go there anyway.
Pat Egan, thank you so much. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 69. And my thanks to all the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studios. Most importantly, today's sound engineer, who is Brian Begley, who every week makes sure we are the world's best sounding podcast. Do please share this podcast with anyone who loves business, and also do subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And that makes sure that Ireland's best business podcast is always in your pocket. And also, if you don't mind giving us 5-star reviews, we like 5-star reviews, and we are here to help businesses like yours. So if there are issues or topics you would like us to cover, contact us on LinkedIn, where we have our dedicated LinkedIn page, and that's been growing over Christmas. It has been phenomenal. We had Brian Caulfield on 67, and we had Harry Goddard of Deloitte, and there were thousands, and I do mean thousands, of new listeners joined us, because again, we can track everything on digital. And if you are planning an ad campaign, we would love to help. Join companies like Big Red Cloud and organizations like ISME and Uderoste Goethe, who recognize it's a great way to talk to Ireland's SMEs. ThatGreatBusinessShow.com will get us. And as always, these great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto, made in Mayo, sold worldwide. Our thanks to them. Pat Egan's just about to use it. So from me, Conal O'Moran, until the next time, Slán tomhán.